how disparate in appearance, stands in Sumer's shadow. Native Americans who left Asia long before agriculture missed out on the bounty. They had to do everything on their own, Crosby said to me. Remarkably, they succeeded. Researchers have long known that a second, independent Neolithic revolution occurred in Mesoamerica. The exact timing is uncertain. Archaeologists keep pushing back the date, but it is now thought to have occurred about 10,000 years ago, not long after the Middle East's Neolithic revolution. In 2003, though, archaeologists discovered ancient seeds from cultivated squashes in coastal Ecuador, at the foot of the Andes, which may be older than any agricultural remains in Mesoamerica. A third Neolithic revolution. This Neolithic revolution probably led, among many other things, to the cultures in the Beni. The two American Neolithics spread more slowly than their counterpart in Eurasia, possibly because Indians in many places had not had the time to build up the requisite population density, and possibly because of the extraordinary nature of the most prominent Indian crop, maize. In the United States and parts of Europe, the name is corn. I use maize because Indian maize, multicolored and mainly eaten after drying and grinding, is strikingly unlike the sweet, yellow uniform kernels usually evoked in North America by the name corn. In Britain, corn can mean the principal cereal crop in a region. Oats in Scotland, for example, are sometimes referred to by the term. The ancestors of wheat, rice, millet, and barley look like their domesticated descendants because they are both edible and highly productive. One can easily imagine how the idea of planting them for food came up. Maize can't reproduce itself because its kernels are securely wrapped in the husk, so Indians must have developed it from some other species. But there are no wild species that resemble maize. Its closest genetic relative is a mountain grass called Teosinte that looks strikingly different. For one thing, its ears are smaller than the baby corn served in Chinese restaurants. No one eats Teosinte because it produces too little grain to be worth harvesting. In creating modern maize from this unpromising plant, Indians performed a feat so improbable that archaeologists and biologists argued for decades over how it was achieved. Coupled with squash, beans, and avocados, maize provided Mesoamerica with a balanced diet, one arguably more nutritious than its Middle Eastern or Asian equivalent. Andean agriculture, based on potatoes and beans, and Amazonian agriculture, based on manioc, cassava, had wide impact, but on a global level were less important than maize. About 7,000 years elapsed between the dawn of the Middle Eastern Neolithic and the establishment of Sumer. Indians navigated the same path in somewhat less time. The data are too sketchy to be more precise. Pride of place must go to the Olmec, the first technologically complex culture in the hemisphere. Appearing in the narrow waste of Mexico about 1800 BC, they lived in cities and towns centered on temple mounds. Strewn among them were colossal male heads of stone, many 6 feet tall or more, with helmet-like headgear, perpetual frowns, and somewhat African features, the last of which has given rise to speculation that Olmec culture was inspired by voyagers from Africa. The Olmec were but the first of many societies that arose in Mesoamerica in this epoch. Most had religions that focused on human sacrifice, dark by contemporary standards. But their economic and scientific accomplishments were bright. They invented a dozen different systems of writing, established widespread trade networks, tracked the orbits of the planets, created a 365-day calendar, more accurate than its contemporaries in Europe, and recorded their histories in accordion-folded books of fig tree bark paper. Arguably, their greatest intellectual feat was the invention of zero. In his classic account, Number, the Language of Science, the mathematician Tobias Danzig called the discovery of zero one of the greatest single accomplishments of the human race, a turning point in mathematics, science, and technology. The first whisper of zero in the Middle East occurred about 600 BC. When tallying numbers, the Babylonians arranged them into columns, as children learn to do today. To distinguish between their equivalents to 11 and 101, they placed two triangular marks between the digits. One triangle triangle one, so to speak. Because Babylonian mathematics was based on 60 rather than 10, the example is correct only in principle. Curiously, though, they did not use the symbol to distinguish among their versions of 1, 10, and 100. Nor could the Babylonians add or subtract with zero, let alone use zero to enter the realm of negative numbers. Mathematicians in India first used zero in its contemporary sense, a number, not a placeholder, sometime in the first few centuries AD. It didn't appear in Europe until the 12th century, when it came in with the Arabic numerals we use today. Fearing fraud, some European governments banned the new numbers. Meanwhile, the first recorded zero in the Americas occurred in a Maya carving from 357 AD, possibly before the Sanskrit. And there are monuments from before the birth of Christ that do not bear zeros themselves, but are inscribed with dates in a calendrical system based on the existence of zero. Does this mean that the Maya were then more advanced than their counterparts in, say, Europe? Social scientists flinch at this question, and with good reason. The Olmec, Maya, and other Mesoamerican societies were world pioneers in mathematics and astronomy. But they did not use the wheel. Amazingly, they had invented the wheel but did not employ it for any purpose other than children's toys. Those looking for a tale of cultural superiority can find it in zero. Those looking for failure can find it in the wheel. Neither line of argument is useful, though. What is most important is that by 1000 AD, Indians had expanded their Neolithic revolutions to create a panoply of diverse civilizations across the hemisphere. 500 years later, when Columbus sailed into the Caribbean, the descendants of the world's Neolithic revolutions collided, with overwhelming consequences for all. A guided tour. Imagine, for a moment, an impossible journey, taking off in a plane from eastern Bolivia as I did, but doing so in 1000 AD and flying a surveillance mission over the rest of the Western Hemisphere. What would be visible from the windows? 50 years ago, most historians would have given a simple answer to this question. Two continents of wilderness, populated by scattered bands whose ways of life had changed little since the Ice Age. The sole exceptions would have been Mexico and Peru, where the Maya and the ancestors of the Inca were crawling towards the foothills of civilization. Today, our understanding is different in almost every perspective. Picture the millennial plane flying west, from the lowlands of the Beni to the heights of the Andes. On the ground beneath as the journey begins are the causeways and canals one sees today, except that they are now in good repair and full of people. 50 years ago, the earthworks were almost completely unknown, even to those living nearby. After a few hundred miles, the plane ascends to the mountains, and again the historical picture has changed. Until recently, researchers would have said the highlands in 1000 AD were occupied by scattered small villages and one or two big towns with some nice stonework. But recent archaeological investigations have revealed that at this time, the Andes housed two mountain states, each much larger than previously appreciated. The state closest to the Beni was based around Lake Titicaca, the 120-mile-long alpine lake that crosses the Peru-Bolivia border. Most of this region has an altitude of 12,000 feet or more. Summers are short. Winters are correspondingly long. This bleak, frigid land, wrote the adventurer Victor von Hagen, seemingly was the last place from which one might expect a culture to develop. But in fact, the lake is comparatively warm, and so the land surrounding it is less beaten by frost than the surrounding highlands. Taking advantage of the better climate, the village of Tiwanaku, one of many settlements around the lake, began after about 800 BC to drain the wetlands around the rivers that flowed into the lake from the south. 1,000 years later, the village had grown to become the center of a large polity, also known as Tiwanaku. Less a centralized state than a clutch of municipalities under the common religio-cultural sway of the center, Tiwanaku took advantage of the extreme ecological differences among the Pacific coast, the rugged mountains, and the Altiplano, the high plains, to create a dense web of exchange. Fish from the sea, llamas from the Altiplano, fruits, vegetables, and grains from the fields around the lake. Flush with wealth, Tiwanaku City swelled into a marvel of terraced pyramids and grand monuments. Stone breakwaters extended far out into Lake Titicaca, thronged with long, proud boats made of reeds. With its running water, closed sewers, and gaudily painted walls, Tiwanaku was among the world's most impressive cities. University of Chicago archaeologist Alan L. Collada excavated at Tiwanaku during the 1980s and early 1990s. He has written that by 1000 AD, the city had a population of as much as 115,000, with another 250,000 in the surrounding countryside, numbers that Paris would not reach for another 5 centuries. The comparison seems fitting. At the time, the realm of Tiwanaku was about the size of modern France. Other researchers believe this population estimate is too high. 20 or 30,000 in the central city is more likely, according to Nicole Couture, a University of Chicago archaeologist who helped edit the definitive publication of Collada's work in 2003. An equal number, she said, occupied the surrounding countryside. Which view is right? Although Couture was confident of her ideas, she thought it would be another decade before the matter was settled. And in any case, the exact number does not affect what she regards as the key point. Building this enormous place up here is really remarkable, she said. I realize that again every time I come back. North and west of Tiwanaku, in what is now southern Peru, was the rival state of Huari, which then ran for almost 1,000 miles along the spine of the Andes. More tightly organized and military-minded than Tiwanaku, the rulers of Huari stamped out cookie-cutter fortresses and stationed them all along their borders. The capital city, called eponymously Huari, was in the heights, near the modern city of Ayacucho. Housing perhaps 70,000 souls, Huari was a dense, alley-packed craze of walled-off temples, hidden courtyards, royal tombs, and apartments up to 6 stories tall. Most of the buildings were sheathed in white plaster, making the city sparkle in the mountain sun. In 1000 AD, at the time of our imaginary overflight, both societies were reeling from a succession of terrible droughts. Perhaps 80 years earlier, dust storms had engulfed the high plains, blackening the glaciers and the peaks above. Ice samples dug out in the 1990s suggest the assault. Then came a run of punishing dry spells, many more than a decade in duration, interrupted by gigantic floods. Sediment and tree ring records depict the sequence. The disaster's cause is still in dispute, but some climatologists believe that the Pacific is subject to mega Niño events, murderously strong versions of the well-known El Niño patterns that play havoc with American weather today. Mega Niños occurred every few centuries between 200 and 1600 AD. In 1925 and 1926, a strong El Niño, not a mega Niño, but one that was bigger than usual, blasted Amazonia with so much dry heat that sudden fires killed hundreds, perhaps thousands, of people in the forest. Rivers dried up, their bottoms carpeted with dead fish. A mega Niño in the 11th century may well have caused the droughts of those years. But whatever the cause of the climactic upheaval, it severely tested Huari and Tiwanaku society. Here, though, one must be careful. Europe was racked by a little ice age of extreme cold between the 14th and 19th centuries. Yet historians rarely attribute the rise and fall of European states in that period to climate change. Fierce winters helped drive the Vikings from Greenland and led to bad harvests that exacerbated social tensions in continental Europe. But few would claim that the Little Ice Age caused the Reformation. Similarly, the Mega Niños were but one of many stresses on Andean civilizations at the time. Stresses that in their totality, neither Wari nor Tiwanaku had the political resources to survive. Soon after 1000 AD, Tiwanaku split into flinders that would not be united for another four centuries, when the Inca swept them up. Wari also fell. It was succeeded and perhaps taken over by a state called Chimor, which oversaw an empire that sprawled over central Peru until it, too, was absorbed by the Inca. Such newly discovered histories appear everywhere in the Americas. Take the plain north, towards Central America and southern Mexico, into the bulge of the Yucatan Peninsula, homeland of the Maya. Maya ruins were well known 40 years ago, to be sure, but among them, too, many new things have been discovered. Consider Calakmul, the ruin that Peter Menzel and I visited in the early 1980s. Almost wholly unexcavated since its discovery, the Calakmul we came to lay swathed in dry, scrubby vegetation that crawled like a swarm of thorns up its two huge pyramids. When Peter and I spoke to William J. Follin of the Universidad Autónoma de Campeche, who was just beginning to work at the city, he recommended that we not try going to the ruin unless we could rent a heavy truck, and not even to try with the truck if it had rained. Our visit to Calakmul did nothing to suggest that Follin's advice was wrong. Trees enveloped the great buildings, their roots slowly ripping apart the soft limestone walls. Peter photographed a monument with roots coiled around it, boa constrictor style, 5 or 6 feet high. So overwhelming was the tropical force that I thought Calakmul's history would remain forever unknown. Happily, I was wrong. By the early 1990s, Follin's team had learned that this long-ignored place covered as much as 25 square miles and had thousands of buildings and dozens of reservoirs and canals. It was the biggest ever Maya polity. Researchers cleaned and photographed its 100-plus monuments, and just in time. For epigraphers, scholars of ancient writing, had in the meantime deciphered Maya hieroglyphics. In 1994, they identified the city-state's ancient name, Khan, the Kingdom of the Snake. 6 years later, they discovered that Khan was the focus of a devastating war that convulsed the Maya city-state for more than a century. And Khan is just one of the score of Maya settlements that in the last few decades have been investigated for the first time. A collection of about 5 dozen kingdoms and city-states in a network of alliances and feuds as convoluted as those of 17th century Germany, the Maya realm was home to one of the world's most intellectually sophisticated cultures. About a century before our imaginary surveillance tour, though, the Maya heartland entered a kind of dark ages. Many of the greatest cities emptied, as did much of the countryside around them. Incredibly, some of the last inscriptions are gibberish, as if scribes had lost the knowledge of writing and were reduced to meaningless imitation of their ancestors. By the time of our overflight, half or more of what once had been the flourishing land of the Maya was abandoned. Some natural scientists attribute this collapse, close in time to that of Wari and Tiwanaku, to a massive drought. The Maya, packed by the millions into land poorly suited to intensive farming, were dangerously close to surpassing the capacity of their ecosystems. The drought, possibly caused by a Mega Niño, pushed the society, already so close to the edge, over the cliff. Such scenarios resonate with contemporary ecological fears, helping to make them popular outside the academy. Within the academy, skepticism is more common. The archaeological record shows that southern Yucatan was abandoned, while Maya cities in the northern part of the peninsula soldiered on or even grew. Peculiarly, the abandoned land was the wettest. with its rivers, lakes, and rainforest, it should have been the best place to wait out a drought. Conversely, northern Yucatan was dry and rocky. The question is why people would have fled from drought to lands that would have been even more badly affected. And what of the rest of Mesoamerica? As the flight continues north, look west, at the hills of what are now the Mexican states of Oaxaca and Guerrero. Here are the quarrelsome city-states of the Nuzahui, Mixtec. Finally, overwhelming the Zapotec, their ancient rivals based in the valley city of Monte Albán. Further north, expanding their empire in a hot-brained hurry, are the Toltec, sweeping in every direction from the mile-high basin that today houses Mexico City. As is often the case, the Toltecs' rapid military success led to political strife. A Shakespearean struggle at the top, complete with accusations of drunkenness and incest, forced out the long-ruling king, Topoltzin Quetzalcoatl, in probably 987 AD. He fled with boatloads of loyalists to the Yucatan Peninsula, promising to return. By the time of our plane trip, Quetzalcoatl had apparently conquered the Maya city of Chichen Itza and was rebuilding it in his own Toltec image. Prominent archaeologists disagree with each other about these events, but the murals and embossed plates at Chichen Itza that depict a Toltec army bloodily destroying a Maya force are hard to dismiss. Continue the flight to what is now the U.S. Southwest, past desert farms and cliff dwellings, to the Mississippian societies in the Midwest. Not long ago, archaeologists with new techniques unraveled the tragedy of Cahokia, near modern St. Louis, which was once the greatest population center north of the Rio Grande. Construction began in about 1000 AD on an earthen structure that would eventually cover 15 acres and rise to a height of about 100 feet, higher than anything around it for miles. Atop the mound was the temple for the divine kings, who arranged for the weather to favor agriculture. As if to lend them support, fields of maize rippled out from the mound almost as far as the eye could see. Despite this apparent evidence of their power, Cahokia's rulers were setting themselves up for future trouble. By mining the forests upstream for firewood and floating the logs downriver to the city, they were removing ground cover and increasing the likelihood of catastrophic floods. When these came, as they later did, kings who gained their legitimacy from their claims to control the weather would face angry questioning from their subjects. Continue north to the least settled land, the realm of hunters and gatherers, portrayed in countless U.S. history books and Hollywood westerns. The Indians of the Great Plains are the most familiar to non-scholars. Demographically speaking, they lived in the hinterlands, remote and thinly settled. Their lives were as far from Wari or Toltec lords as the nomads of Siberia were from the grandees of Beijing. Their material cultures were simpler, too. No writing, no stone plazas, no massive temples. Though plains groups did leave behind about 50 rings of rock that are reminiscent of Stonehenge. The relative lack of material goods has led some to regard these groups as exemplifying an ethic of living lightly on the land. Perhaps, but North America was a busy, talkative place. By 1000 AD, trade relationships had covered the continent for more than 1,000 years. Mother of Pearl from the Gulf of Mexico has been found in Manitoba, and Lake Superior copper in Louisiana. Or forgo the northern route altogether and fly the imaginary plane east from the Beni, toward the mouth of the Amazon. Immediately after the Beni, one encounters, in what is now the western Brazilian state of Acre, the beginnings of other societies, different but related. They will build earthworks like those in the Beni, but they will be shaped into striking geometric patterns quite unlike those found in the Beni. Even less is known about these people. The first widely available scholarly article on them did not appear until 2009, and new findings are coming every year. According to the Finnish archaeologists who first brought the Acre earthworks to attention, It is obvious that relatively high population densities were quite common everywhere in the Amazonian lowlands. The Finns here are summing up the belief of a new generation of researchers into the Amazon. Much of the river was more crowded in 1000 AD than it is now, especially in its lower half. Dense collections of villages throng the bluffs that line the shore, with their people fishing in the river and farming the floodplains and sections of the uplands. Most important were the village orchards that marched back from the bluffs for miles. Amazonians practice a kind of agroforestry, farming with trees, unlike any kind of agriculture in Europe, Africa, or Asia. Not all the towns were small. Near the Atlantic was the chiefdom of Marajo, based on an enormous island at the mouth of the river. Marajo's population, recently estimated at 100,000, may have been equaled or even surpassed by a still nameless agglomeration of people 600 miles upstream, at Santarim, a pleasant town that today is sleeping off the effects of Amazonia's past rubber and gold booms. The ancient inhabitation beneath and around the modern town has barely been investigated. Almost all that we know is that it was ideally located on a high bluff, overlooking the mouth of the Tapajos, one of the Amazon's biggest tributaries. On this bluff, geographers and archaeologists in the 1990s found an area more than 3 miles long that was thickly covered with broken ceramics, much like Ibibate. According to William I. Woods, an archaeologist and geographer at the University of Kansas, the region could have supported as many as 400,000 inhabitants, at least in theory, making it one of the bigger population centers in the world. And so on. Western scholars have written histories of the world since at least the 12th century. As children of their own societies, these early historians naturally emphasized the culture they knew best, the culture their readership most wanted to hear about. But over time, they added the stories of other places in the world, chapters about China, India, Persia, Japan, and other places. Researchers tip their hats to non-Western accomplishments in the sciences and arts. Sometimes the effort was grudging or minimal, but the vacant reaches in the human tale slowly contracted. One way to sum up the new scholarship is to say that it has begun, at last, to fill in one of the biggest blanks in history, the Western Hemisphere before 1492. It was, in the current view, a thriving, stunningly diverse place, a tumult of languages, trade, and culture. A region where tens of millions of people loved and hated and worshipped, as people do everywhere. Much of this world vanished after Columbus, swept away by disease and subjugation. So thorough was the erasure that within a few generations, neither conqueror nor conquered knew that this world had existed. Now, though, it is returning to view. It seems incumbent on us to take a look. Part 1. Numbers from Nowhere. Chapter 2. Why Billington Survived. The Friendly Indian. On March 22, 1621, an official Native American delegation walked through what is now southern New England to negotiate with a group of foreigners who had taken over a recently deserted Indian settlement. At the head of the party was an uneasy triumvirate, Massasoit, the sachem, political military leader of the Wampanoag Confederation, a loose coalition of several dozen villages that controlled most of southeastern Massachusetts. Somerset, sachem of an allied group to the north, and Tisquantum, a distrusted captive, whom Massasoit had recently brought along as an interpreter. Massasoit was an adroit politician, but the dilemma he faced would have tested Machiavelli. About 5 years before, most of his subjects had fallen before a terrible calamity. Whole villages had been depopulated. Indeed, the foreigners ahead now occupied one of the empty sites. It was all he could do to hold together the remnants of his people. Adding to his problems, the disaster had not touched the Wampanoag's longtime enemies, the Narragansett Alliance to the west. Soon, Massasoit feared, they would take advantage of the Wampanoag's weakness and overrun them. Desperate threats required desperate countermeasures. In a gamble, Massasoit intended to abandon, even reverse, a long-standing policy. Europeans had been visiting New England for at least a century. Shorter than the natives, oddly dressed, and often unbearably dirty, the pallid foreigners had peculiar blue eyes that peeped out of the masks of bristly, animal-like hair that encased their faces. They were irritatingly garrulous, prone to fits of chicanery, and often surprisingly incompetent at what seemed to Indians like basic tasks. But they also made useful and beautiful goods. Copper kettles, glittering colored glass, and steel knives and hatchets, unlike anything else in New England. Moreover, they would exchange these valuable items for cheap furs of the sort used by Indians as blankets. It was like happening upon a dingy kiosk that would swap fancy electronic goods for customers' used socks. Almost anyone would be willing to overlook the shopkeeper's peculiarities. Over time, the Wampanoag, like other native societies in coastal New England, had learned how to manage the European presence. They encouraged the exchange of goods, but would only allow their visitors to stay ashore for brief, carefully controlled excursions. Those who overstayed their welcome were forcefully reminded of the limited duration of Indian hospitality. At the same time, the Wampanoag fended off Indians from the interior, preventing them from trading directly with the foreigners. In this way, the shoreline groups put themselves in the position of classic middlemen, overseeing both European access to Indian products and Indian access to European products. Now Massasoit was visiting a group of British with the intent of changing the rules. He would permit the newcomers to stay for an unlimited time, provided they formally allied with the Wampanoag against the Narragansett. Tisquantum, the interpreter, had shown up alone at Massasoit's home a year and a half before. He spoke fluent English because he had lived for several years in Britain. But Massasoit didn't trust him. He seems to have been, in Massasoit's eyes, a man without anchor, out for himself. In a conflict, Tisquantum might even side with the foreigners. Massasoit had kept Tisquantum in a kind of captivity since his arrival, monitoring his actions closely. And he refused to use him to negotiate with the colonists until he had another, independent means of communication with them. That March, Samoset, the third member of the triumvirate, appeared, having hitched a ride from his home in Maine on an English ship that was plying the coast. Not known as whether his arrival was due to chance, or if Massasoit had asked him to come down because he had picked up a few English phrases by trading with the British. In any case, Massasoit first had sent Samoset rather than Tisquantum to the foreigners. Samoset had walked unaccompanied and unarmed into the circle of rude huts in which the British were living on March 17, 1621. The colonists saw a robust, erect-postured man wearing only a loincloth. His straight black hair was shaved in front, but flowed down his shoulders behind. To their further amazement, this almost naked man greeted them in broken but understandable English. He left the next morning with a few presents. A day later, he came back, accompanied by five tall, proper men. The phrase is the colonist Edward Winslow's. With 3-inch black stripes painted down the middle of their faces. The two sides talked inconclusively, each warily checking out the other for a few hours. Now, on the 22nd, Samoset showed up again at the foreigner's ramshackle base, this time with Tisquantum in tow. Meanwhile, Massasoit and the rest of the Indian company waited out of sight. Samoset and Tisquantum spoke with the colonists for about an hour. Perhaps they then gave a signal. Or perhaps Massasoit was simply following a prearranged schedule. In any case, he and the rest of the Indian party appeared without warning at the crest of a hill on the south bank of the creek that ran through the foreigners' camp. Alarmed by Massasoit's sudden entrance, the Europeans withdrew to the hill on the opposite bank, where they had emplaced their few cannons behind a half-finished stockade. A standoff ensued. Finally, Winslow exhibited the decisiveness that later led to his selection as colony governor. Wearing a full suit of armor and carrying a sword, he waded through the stream and offered himself as a hostage. Tisquantum, who walked with him, served as interpreter. Massasoit's brother took charge of Winslow, and then Massasoit crossed the water himself, followed by Tisquantum and 20 of Massasoit's men, all ostentatiously unarmed. The colonist took the sachem to an unfinished house and gave him some cushions to recline on. Both sides shared some of the foreigner's homemade moonshine, then settled down to talk, Tisquantum translating. To the colonists, Massasoit could be distinguished from his subjects more by manner than by dress or ornament. He wore the same deerskin shawls and leggings, and like his fellows, had covered his face with bug-repelling oil and reddish-purple dye. Around his neck hung a pouch of tobacco, a long knife, and a thick chain of the prized white shell beads called wampum. In appearance, Winslow wrote afterward, he was a very lusty man in his best years, an able body, grave of countenance, and spare of speech. The Europeans who had barely survived the previous winter were in much worse shape. Half of the original colony now lay underground beneath wooden markers painted with death's heads. Most of the survivors were malnourished. Their meeting was a critical moment in American history. The foreigners called their colony Plymouth. Most spelled it P-L-I-M-O-T-H. They themselves were the famous Pilgrims. The Mayflower passengers are often called Puritans, but they disliked the name. Instead, they used terms like separatist, because they separated themselves from the Church of England, or saints, because their church, patterned on the early Christian church, was the Church of Saints. Pilgrims is the title preferred by the Society of Mayflower Descendants. As schoolchildren learn, at that meeting the Pilgrims obtained the services of Tisquantum, usually known as Squanto. In the 1970s, when I attended high school, a popular history text was America, Its People and Values by Leonard C. Wood, Ralph H. Gabriel, and Edward L. Biller. Nestled among colorful illustrations of colonial life was a succinct explanation of Tisquantum's role. A friendly Indian named Squanto helped the colonists. He showed them how to plant corn and how to live on the edge of the wilderness. A soldier, Captain Miles Standish, taught the Pilgrims how to defend themselves against unfriendly Indians. My teacher explained that maize was unfamiliar to the Pilgrims and that Tisquantum had demonstrated the proper maize planting technique. Sticking the seed in little heaps of dirt, accompanied by beans and squash that would later twine themselves up the tall stalks. And he told the Pilgrims to fertilize the soil by burying fish alongside the maize seeds, a traditional native technique for producing a bountiful harvest. Following this advice, my teacher said, the colonists grew so much maize that it became the centerpiece of the first Thanksgiving. In our slipshod fashion, we students took notes. The story in America, Its People and Values isn't wrong, so far as it goes. But the impression it gives is entirely misleading. Tisquantum was critical to the colony's survival. Contemporary scholars agree. He moved to Plymouth after the meeting and spent the rest of his life there. Just as my teacher said, Tisquantum told the colonists to bury several small fish in each maize hill, a procedure followed by European colonists for two centuries. Squanto's teachings, Winslow concluded, led to a good increase of Indian corn, the difference between success and starvation. Winslow didn't know that fish fertilizer may not have been an age-old Indian custom, but a recent invention, if it was an Indian practice at all. So little evidence has emerged of Indians fertilizing with fish that some archaeologists believe that Tisquantum actually picked up the idea from European farmers. The notion is not as ridiculous as it may seem. Tisquantum had learned English because British sailors had kidnapped him 7 years before. To return to the Americas, he in effect had to escape twice. Once from Spain, where his captors initially sold him into slavery, and once from England, to which he was smuggled from Spain, and where he served as a kind of living conversation piece at a rich man's house. In his travels, Tisquantum stayed in places where Europeans used fish as fertilizer, a practice on the continent since medieval times. Skipping over the complex course of Tisquantum's life is understandable in a textbook with limited space. But the omission is symptomatic of the complete failure to consider Indian motives, or even that Indians might have motives. The alliance Massasoit negotiated with Plymouth was successful from the Wampanoag perspective, for it helped to hold off the Narragansett. But it was a disaster from the point of view of New England Indian society as a whole, for the alliance ensured the survival of Plymouth Colony, which spearheaded the great wave of British immigration to New England. All of this was absent not only from my high school textbooks, but from the academic accounts they were based on. This variant of Holmberg's mistake dates back to the Pilgrims themselves, who ascribed the lack of effective native resistance to the will of God. Divine providence, the colonist Daniel Gookin wrote, favored the quiet and peaceable settlement of the English. Later writers tended to attribute European success not to European deities, but to European technology. In a contest where only one side had rifles and cannons, historians said, the other side's motives were irrelevant. By the end of the 19th century, the Indians of the Northeast were thought of as rapidly fading background details in the saga of the rise of the United States. Marginal people who were losers in the end, as James Axtell of the College of William and Mary dryly put it in an interview. Vietnam War-era denunciations of the Pilgrims as imperialists or racists simply replicated the error in a new form. Whether the cause was the Pilgrim God, Pilgrim guns, or Pilgrim greed, native losses were foreordained. Indians cannot have stopped colonization in this view, and they hardly tried. Beginning in the 1970s, Axtell, Neil Salisbury, Francis Jennings, and other historians grew dissatisfied with this view. Indians were seen as trivial, ineffectual patsies, Salisbury, a historian emeritus at Smith College, told me. But that assumption, a whole continent of patsies, simply didn't make sense. These researchers tried to peer through the colonial records to the Indian lives beneath. Their work fed a tsunami of inquiry into the interactions between natives and newcomers, in the era when they faced each other as relative equals. No other field in American history has grown as fast, marveled Joyce Chaplin, a Harvard historian, in 2003. The fall of Indian societies had everything to do with the natives themselves, researchers argue, rather than being religiously or technologically determined. Here the claim is not that indigenous culture should be blamed for their own demise, but that they helped to determine their own fates. When you look at the historical record, it's clear that Indians were trying to control their own destinies, Salisbury said, and often enough they succeeded. Only to learn, as all peoples do, that the consequences were not what they expected. This chapter and the next will explore how two different Indian societies, the Wampanoag and the Inca, reacted to the incursions from across the sea. It may seem odd that a book about Indian life before contact should devote space to the period after contact, but there are reasons for it. First, colonial descriptions of Native Americans are among the first glimpses we have of Indians whose lives were not shaped by the presence of Europe. The accounts of the initial encounters between Indians and Europeans are windows into the past, even if the glass is smeared and distorted by the chronicler's prejudices and misapprehensions. Second, although the stories of early contact, the Wampanoag with the English, the Inca with the Spaniards, are as dissimilar as their protagonists, many archaeologists, anthropologists, and historians have recently come to believe that they have deep commonalities, and the tales of other Indians' encounters with the strangers were alike in the same way. The separate nations of Europe were linguistically and culturally different one from another. native societies were astonishingly diverse. Yet despite these great dissimilarities, the stories of the encounter run in broad parallel. When native met newcomer, both groups tried to benefit, as people will. In almost every case, each side believed itself to be superior. Ethnocentrism seems to be a near universal human quality. And from this belief was convinced that it could control the encounter to its advantage. But even though these various groups had wildly varying ideas about what they wanted and how to get it, the outcome was similar enough that researchers have constructed what might be thought of as a master narrative of the meeting of Europe and America. Although it remains surprisingly little known outside specialist circles, this master narrative illuminates the origins of every nation in the Americas today. More than that, the effort to understand events after Columbus shed unexpected light on critical aspects of life before Columbus. Indeed, the master narrative led to such surprising conclusions about Native American societies before the arrival of Europeans that it stirred up an intellectual firestorm. Coming of Age in the Dawn Land. Consider Tisquantum, the friendly Indian of the textbook. More than likely, Tisquantum was not the name he was given at birth. In that part of the Northeast, Tisquantum referred to rage, especially the rage of Manitou, the world-suffusing spiritual power at the heart of coastal Indians' religious beliefs. When Tisquantum approached the pilgrims and identified himself by that sobriquet, it was as if he had stuck out his hand and said, "Hello, I'm the wrath of God." No one would lightly adopt such a name in contemporary Western society. Neither would anyone in 17th century indigenous society. Tisquantum was trying to project something. Tisquantum was not an Indian. True, he belonged to that category of people whose ancestors had inhabited the Western Hemisphere for thousands of years. And it is true that I refer to him as an Indian, because the label is useful shorthand. So would his descendants. And for much the same reason. But Indian was not a category that Tisquantum himself would have recognized, any more than the inhabitants of the same area today would call themselves Western Hemispherians. Still less would Tisquantum have claimed to belong to Norumbega, the label by which most Europeans then referred to New England. New England was coined only in 1616. As Tisquantum's later history made clear, he regarded himself first and foremost as a citizen of Patuxent, a shoreline settlement halfway between what is now Boston and the beginning of Cape Cod. Patuxent was one of the dozen or so settlements in what is now eastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island that comprised the Wampanoag Confederation. In turn, the Wampanoag were part of a tripartite alliance with two other confederations, the Nauset, which comprised some 30 groups on Cape Cod, and the Massachusett, several dozen villages clustered around Massachusetts Bay. All of these people spoke variants of Massachusett, a member of the Algonquian language family, the biggest in eastern North America at the time. Massachusett, thus, was the name both of a language and one of the groups that spoke it. In Massachusett, the name for the New England shore was the Dawnland, the place where the sun rose. The inhabitants of the Dawnland were the people of the first light. 10,000 years ago, when Indians in Mesoamerica and Peru were inventing agriculture and coalescing into villages, New England was barely inhabited, for the excellent reason that it had been covered until relatively recently by an ice sheet a mile thick. People slowly moved in, though the area long remained cold and uninviting, especially along the coastline. Because rising sea levels continually flooded the shore, marshy Cape Cod did not fully lock into its contemporary configuration until about 1000 BC. By that time, the Dawnland had evolved into something more attractive, an ecological crazy quilt of wet maple forests, shellfish-studded tidal estuaries, thick highland woods, mossy bogs full of cranberries and orchids, fractally complex snarls of sandbars and beachfront, and fire-swept stands of pitch pine. Tremendous variety even within the compass of a few miles, as the ecological historian William Cronin put it. In the absence of written records, researchers have developed techniques for teasing out evidence of the past. Among them is glottochronology, the attempt to estimate how long ago two languages separated from a common ancestor by evaluating their degree of divergence on a list of key words. In the 1970s and 1980s, linguists applied glottochronological techniques to the Algonquian dictionaries compiled by early colonists. However tentatively, the results indicated that the various Algonquian languages in New England all date back to a common ancestor that appeared in the Northeast a few centuries before Christ. The ancestral language may derive from what is known as the Hopewell culture. Around 2,000 years ago, Hopewell jumped into prominence from its bases in the Midwest, establishing a trade network that covered most of North America. The Hopewell culture introduced monumental earthworks and, possibly, agriculture to the rest of the cold North. Although Hopewell villages were as small as those of their more egalitarian neighbors, they were stratified, with priestly rulers controlling the rest of the populace. Archaeologists have found no evidence of large-scale warfare at this time, and thus suggest that Hopewell probably did not achieve its dominance by conquest. Instead, one can speculate, the vehicle for transformation may have been Hopewell religion, with its intoxicatingly elaborate funeral rites. If so, the adoption of Algonquian in the Northeast would mark an era of spiritual ferment and heady conversion, much like the time when Islam rose and spread Arabic throughout the Middle East. Hopewell itself declined around 400 AD, but its trade network remained intact. Shell beads from Florida, obsidian from the Rocky Mountains, and mica from Tennessee found their way to the Northeast. Borrowing technology and ideas from the Midwest, the nomadic peoples of New England transformed their societies. By the end of the first millennium AD, agriculture was spreading rapidly, and the region was becoming an unusual patchwork of communities, each with its preferred terrain, way of subsistence, and cultural style. Scattered about the many lakes, ponds, and swamps of the cold uplands were small, mobile groups of hunters and gatherers. Collectors, as researchers sometimes call them. Most had recently adopted agriculture or were soon to do so. But it was still a secondary source of food, a supplement to the wild products of the land. New England's major river valleys, by contrast, held large permanent villages, many nestled in constellations of suburban hamlets and hunting camps. Because extensive fields of maize, beans, and squash surrounded every home, these settlements sprawled along the Connecticut, Charles, and other river valleys for miles, one town bumping up against the other. Along the coast, where Tisquantum and Massasoit lived, villages often were smaller and looser, though no less permanent. Unlike the upland hunters, the Indians on the rivers and coastline did not roam the land. Instead, most seem to have moved between a summer place and a winter place, like affluent snowbirds alternating between Manhattan and Miami. The distances were smaller, of course. Shoreline families would move a 15-minute walk inland to avoid direct exposure to winter storms and tides. Each village had its own distinct mix of farming and foraging. This one here, adjacent to a rich oyster bed, might plant maize purely for variety, whereas that one there, just a few miles away, might subsist almost entirely on its harvest, filling great underground storage pits each fall. Although these settlements were permanent, winter and summer alike, they often were not tightly knit entities, with houses and fields in carefully demarcated clusters. Instead, people spread themselves through estuaries, sometimes grouping into neighborhoods, sometimes with each family on its own, its maize ground proudly separate. Each community was constantly joining and splitting like quicksilver in a fluid pattern within its bounds, wrote Kathleen J. Bragdon, an anthropologist at the College of William and Mary. A type of settlement, she remarked, with no name in the archaeological or anthropological literature. In the Wampanoag Confederation, one of these Quicksilver communities was Patuxent, where Tisquantum was born at the end of the 16th century. Tucked into the great sweep of Cape Cod Bay, Patuxent sat on a low rise above a small harbor, jigsawed by sandbars and shallow enough that children could walk from the beach hundreds of yards into the water before the waves went above their heads. To the west, maize hills marched across the sandy hillocks in parallel rows. Beyond the fields, a mile or more away from the sea, rose a forest of oak, chestnut, and hickory, open and park-like, the underbrush kept down by expert annual burning. Pleasant of air and prospect, as one English visitor described the area, Patuxent had much plenty both of fish and fowl every day in the year. Runs of spawning Atlantic salmon, short-nosed sturgeon, striped bass, and American shad annually filled the harbor. But the most important fish harvest came in late spring, when the herring-like alewives swarmed the fast, shallow stream that cut through the village. So numerous were the fish, and so driven, that when mischievous boys walled off the stream with stones, the alewives would leap the barrier, silver bodies gleaming in the sun, and proceed upstream. Tisquantum's childhood Weetu, home, was formed from arched poles lashed together into a dome that was covered in winter by tightly woven rush mats, and in summer by thin sheets of chestnut bark. A fire burned constantly in the center, the smoke venting through a hole in the center of the roof. English visitors did not find this arrangement peculiar. Chimneys were just coming into use in Britain, and most homes there, including those of the wealthy, were still heated by fires beneath central roof holes. Nor did the English regard the Dawnland Weetu as primitive. Its multiple layers of mats, which trapped insulating layers of air, were warmer than our English houses, sighed the colonist William Wood. The Weetu was less leaky than the typical English wattle and daub house, too. Wood did not conceal his admiration for the way Indian mats deny entrance to any drop of rain, though it come both fierce and long. Around the edge of the house were low beds, sometimes wide enough for a whole family to sprawl on them together, usually raised about a foot from the floor, platform style, and always piled with mats and furs. Going to sleep in the firelight, young Tisquantum would have stared up at the dithering shadows of the hemp bags and bark boxes hanging from the rafters. Voices would skirl up in the darkness, one person singing a lullaby, then another person, until everyone was asleep. In the morning, when he woke, big egg-shaped pots of corn and bean mash would be on the fire, simmering with meat, vegetables, or dried fish to make a slow-cooked dinner stew. Outside the Weetu, he would hear the cheerful thuds of the large mortars and pestles in which women crushed dried maize into no-cake. A flour-like powder so sweet, toothsome, and hearty, colonist Gookin wrote, that an Indian will travel many days with no other but this meal. Although Europeans bemoaned the lack of salt in Indian cuisine, they thought it nourishing. According to one modern reconstruction, Dawnland diets at the time averaged about 2,500 calories a day, better than those usual in famine-racked Europe. Pilgrim writers universally reported that Wampanoag families were close and loving, more so than English families, some thought. Europeans in those days tended to view children as moving straight from infancy to adulthood around the age of 7, and often thereupon set them out to work. Indian parents, by contrast, regarded the years before puberty as a time of playful development and kept their offspring close by until marriage. Jarringly, to the present-day eye, some pilgrims interpreted this as sparing the rod. Boys like Tisquantum explored the countryside, swam in the ponds at the south end of the harbor, and played a kind of soccer with a small leather ball. In the summer and fall, they camped out in huts in the fields, weeding the maize and chasing away birds. Archery practice began at age 2. By adolescence, boys would make a game of shooting at each other and dodging the arrows. The primary goal of Dawnland education was molding character. Men and women were expected to be brave, hardy, honest, and uncomplaining. Chatterboxes and gossips were frowned upon. He that speaks seldom and opportunely, being as good as his word, is the only man they love.